few examples of some of the early strategies. I'd love to hear some of the great science that's now being done here in Texas to survey, map springs, to characterize their physiography and their water quality. I think in some ways Florida was way behind in that respect. Many of our springs we didn't even know existed. Many of them were just anecdotally located out in the woods somewhere. They were never mapped. We spent quite a bit of money initially doing spring surveys, trying to get our knowledge base up to snuff and doing biological inventories in those springs. One of the most interesting things or significant findings in some of the biological inventories, finding out what plants and animals inhabited these springs, was to learn that the limpkin, which is a fairly unique wading bird, I believe it might get into South Texas, I'm not sure, but it's fairly unique to Florida and South America, once was sort of a real icon of springs. It's now missing from most of the Florida springs where it used to occur. And we think that is because of the heavy nutrient loading coming into these springs has shifted the ecology such that the habitat for the Florida apple snail, which is the limpkin's only food source for the most part, is now no longer able to survive in many of the places where it once did. We nearly doubled the number of known and mapped springs as a result of these spring surveys. We had been touting 400 or so large Florida and aquifer springs for many years. It's now the figure is over 700, as I mentioned at the outset. We've done quite a bit of spring shed delineation, delineating the areas that are contributing, the areas of the grounds to the land surface that are contributing to springs and the flow of springs, dye studies to connect some sinks with springs, flow and water quality monitoring. We don't have any that goes back to the late 1800s like Texas does, and perilously few springs of any kind were monitored in Florida until the last 10 to 20 years. We completed something called a Florida Aquifer Vulnerability Assessment, which is a way of getting at a better picture of where the best recharge lands are and where the areas that are most vulnerable to contamination are located. Spring carrying capacity studies on some of the more heavily used springs. Commissioned these studies with consultants to develop recommendations for access, for daily quotas of visitors, for resting periods, better ways of more passive and low impact ways of getting boats into these systems or keeping boats out, boardwalks, other kinds of things like that. These have been now implemented at four different springs. We've funded about 20, I believe it's 23 local restoration projects. Many of them are focusing on erosion control, the direct consequences of some of this overuse and heavy visitation. And others are focused on local septic systems or sewer lines that may have been contributing to contamination or as contamination sources. Local education and landowner assistance projects, kiosks. We've held two conferences, very much like this one you're at here today, on Florida springs, workshops, displays and exhibits at county fairs. You name it, we've probably been out there doing it as far as education. The Water's Journey video that I mentioned. We've taken a cue from Texas and installed signs along roadways where you're entering or leaving, particularly important spring recharge areas. And landowner assistance projects for the privately owned springs, for doing restoration projects of similar type. Very significantly, we've leveraged another large source of money in Florida. We have a $300 million a year conservation land acquisition program in Florida called Florida Forever. It's been going under various names since about 1990 with funding, as I say, $300 million a year annually. And this is a role that the Nature Conservancy played in influencing this and designing a project for Florida Ever that was then nominated by a state board to move forward for funding. This is called the Florida's First Magnitude Springs Project, And it essentially is focusing, or in these early, up until 2004, was focusing on protecting or bringing into public ownership some of the last remaining first magnitude, those big, big springs that were still in private ownership, several of which were still operated as sort of low-budget tourist attractions. And we've brought five additional springs for a total of 15 state parks now that are that have large Floridan springs on them. And many cases have begun the process to do some ecological restoration in these places. These are just a quick few slides showing some pictures of some of these strategies. This was just depicting the delineation of spring sheds, much like you have here in the Edwards Aquifer, where there's a surface watershed that contributes to recharge, and then a ground watershed, maybe some sinkholes that contribute to the spring flow. Through some of the some of the work done with dye studies, we've been able to connect what were thought to be previously isolated sinkholes and conduits we didn't know existed to certain springs, and thus broaden our horizons, broaden our perspective on what the spring should actually look like. This is the Florida Aquifer Vulnerability Study, just an output from that, where you see the higher, the darker red or orange areas are the areas of greater vulnerability to contamination. They also tend to be the higher recharge areas. And this is just a particular spring shed, the Wakaiba spring shed, overlaid on that same map. A couple of the studies, and this is one of the carrying capacity studies for Silver Glen Springs. That's the one with all the boats packed in there, and the Water's Journey video. Now, in 2005, the legislature, anxious to see the fruits of their labors and maybe anxious to trumpet some of the successes back home to constituents, asked the Springs Task Force. And I should say the Springs Task Force has played an advisory role. The initiative itself is staffed by state employees from the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. The Springs Task Force is actually the advisory body who develops the priorities for funding, brings the issues to the table, and keeps the essentially plans for the future, plans out what projects or priorities need to be implemented to protect springs. As we took stock of our accomplishments in light of the legislature's request, it occurred to us that even though we'd had some fairly significant successes at individual springs, we've done restoration at key springs here and there, and there were some really good successes out there, we still had a long way to go in terms of protecting the whole suite of springs out there on the landscape. So the upshot of that was that we prepared a second report, this time a more focused report, and I have a copy of this if anybody wants to ask me questions about it later or take a look at it. I believe this is also available now just this week on the website for the Florida Springs Initiative. This is our report that was completed in May of last year. It is a much more focused action plan rather than just a call to action. It is actually a specific set of actions identified to really prioritized on what we feel are the highest priority things that we need to do. We broadened our focus of our strategies from individual springs and trying to protect the head springs and spring runs to now focusing on the spring shed. This is really a kind of a simple concept, but it was a bit elusive, and it's really powerful to people once they realize that there's a spring shed out there that includes all our backyards and where we go to work and the places we recreate and do business and go to church, and you know all of our human activities on the land are in one of these spring sheds in North Florida, and it's a powerful concept to be able to describe where that is and see how your actions and your neighbor's actions affect the springs and the health of those springs. So we broadened our focus of our strategies on the activities taking place in those springs or spring sheds. We identified strategies with higher leverage, as I said earlier, to make that $2.5 million, because it looked like that's going to continue to be what we get from the legislature, to extend that money well beyond the $2.5 million. An example is that $300 million a year land acquisition program. prioritize the strategies which address the most serious threats, what we call in the Nature Conservancy the killer threats, those four that I highlighted earlier. And very significantly, we enabled through this new plan something called Springs Working Groups. Essentially, this is taking the task force and replicating it at the local level and focusing entirely on the spring sheds. The Springs Working Groups are funded, as far as their operations and administration, through the Springs Initiative money, but they're actually carried out and implemented by local people. In some cases, we may have a coordinator who's hired and actually paid to do the administrative work, but all of the actors are people. They're local business leaders. They're people from the local media. A lot of these are very small town places like Lake City, Florida, Mayo, Florida. Lots of little towns with Seminole names like the rivers. And the whole focus is to be advocates and champions for those springs and to sort of be watchdogs and be the voice for the springs within those spring sheds. They've been very, very successful. The people chosen have been, like the Springs Task Force, very committed locally, very, very much personally connected to springs, able to influence locally, able to go talk to the local newspaper publisher and get that person excited about springs and be able to publish things. A lot of what they do is education, but we've seen some real changes resulting from education. I mean, things like old timers' days at the springs where they bring people who are 85 years plus in to sort of reminisce about what the springs were like in their days and barbecues and things like that. And we plan to do a lot more of that as we can replicate them at other springs. There's now six of those Springs Working Groups operating, and then two what we call Springs Ambassador positions, which are sort of the next level down from the working groups. They're single people for now who are sort of acting as the Springs champions in their incipient working groups, I guess you'd say. Some of the strategies, kind of finish up here with some of the strategies, then talk about lessons learned. Some of the strategies we've now implemented since around the same time that this latest report was coming out, and since then, much more broad-based, again, much more focused on the spring sheds. We're continuing to do science and research, but much more targeted now at things like developing numerical nutrient criteria and flow standards for springs. And we have some tools in our state law in Florida that allow us to build on that. Accelerating the development of minimum flows and levels for publicly owned springs, particularly first magnitude springs. Again, this is a concept in Florida statute that allows the water management districts to set minimum flows that beyond which significant harm would be expected of the spring ecosystem, and to hold water allocation through its permitting process to levels well above that minimum flow. It's intended to be a sort of a safety net, and the permitting process is intended to hold the allocation process or the water somewhere above that minimum flow. But we've accelerated the determination of minimum flows for certain springs. We are developing urban best management practices for spring sheds, including land development regulations, model springs land codes, a springs land guidebook, model land use code that's been shopped in Citrus County and now is being taken by our Department of Community Affairs, which is our state planning, land planning agency, around to various counties for adoption. Assistance with the counties and local municipalities in delineating springs protection zones. I mentioned we've established these working groups and spring ambassador positions. And then significantly moving the focus of our land acquisition efforts now away from those head springs, now that work is done, and now focusing much more on acquiring lands in the spring sheds themselves. We've acquired, just in the last 5 years, 34,000 acres through partnerships with local municipalities, the Nature Conservancy, the state, in critical spring sheds. And these were not just, you know, piecemeal projects that were here and there and happened to be in a spring shed. These were 34,000 acres specifically targeted for spring shed protection, clustered in particular springs. There's over 4,000 acres in the Wakulla Springs Basin alone. Now that sounds like a lot, or may sound like a lot, but it's a drop in the bucket compared to what probably ultimately needs to be done. There was a very important legislative act that resulted from one of these springs working groups in the Wakaiva Basin, which resulted in legislation which affects for the first time, governs for the first time the land uses and land practices that that are allowed in an important spring basin. And then a partnership with dairy farmers and poultry farmers in the Suwannee River Basin started out as a sort of a vaguely ill-defined project to help the quality of the Suwannee River, has blossomed into a very innovative partnership where with, I think there's something like 20 demonstration farms using and monitoring, assessing best management practices for waste and manure handling and other factors that contribute to high nutrient loading of the groundwater, which eventually ends up in the springs in the Suwannee River. Again, a few of the reports and products that have come out of these strategies. This was a handbook that was actually distributed to all the residents of certain counties on how to take care of your yard in a spring basin. The Springs Land Use Planning Strategies Guidebook for municipal officials, delineation of certain spring sheds, and then some of the land protection work, including two that we've been involved in. One at Silver Springs of about 4,000 acres and a similar amount over here in the Wakulla Springs Basin. Present status. We're at a crossroads right now with the Springs Initiative. There are three different legislators right now who in the present legislative session in Florida have introduced springs protection legislation. The most sweeping of those creates a sustainable funding mechanism. Instead of just an annual appropriation, we're looking now at a trust fund, a state trust fund that's probably will be supported by a piece of the documentary stamp revenue for funding our springs projects. We're looking at transitioning the Springs Task Force into a more permanent body, probably called a Springs Council, that'll probably play a similar role. And there'll be some provisions, presumably, that will implement the total maximum daily loads for nutrients in five or six key springs. Calling for some fairly wide, far-reaching land use changes or land use regulations in key springs that are now impaired. Accordingly, we're the Springs Initiative, which has been a standalone initiative within our DEP, is being integrated more holistically into their watershed management division, which is probably a good move because it really starts to put the springs into the perspective of the entire watershed. Lessons learned. I'll end with this. This is what I guess I was asked to really talk about here. Series of things we've learned. I don't think we've been completely successful. I think we've still got a long ways to go to protect springs in Florida. We've got some similar challenges to Texas and some different challenges. Some of our threats are a little more intense. We've got a lot more land in public ownership. There's a great tradition here in Texas of good private stewardship, and you know that's very heartening to see. We're on a little bit of a different trajectory in Florida. Some of the lessons we've learned from the now 8 years of the Springs Task Force and the Springs Initiative. First and foremost, if you're going to create a body like this that is charged with protecting springs or developing strategies to protect springs, we've learned and we've benefited from the fact that this is an action group. It's a group of people who were selected not just because they're stakeholders or have some interest in springs that needs to be protected, but because these were people capable of getting things done, and people who are capable of influencing others for the benefit of the springs. And that's I serve in my capacity, I'm the Director of Conservation Science in Florida for the Nature Conservancy, and I serve on numerous boards and advisory committees. This one is one of the best that I've ever served on because of that, because people are so committed, and it is really an action group and not just a study group or a stakeholder group. Stakeholder groups can be action groups, but they need to be action groups first and foremost. We have cultivated and capitalized on the personal connections that people have with springs in North Florida. It's a blessing for us that all of us grew up with these springs, and I think it's been very helpful in galvanizing some of these what sound like fairly extreme solutions, and maybe the legislation and things like that that you wouldn't expect would happen in other places. And these, you know, mind you, are very conservative-minded people in most ways. Very rural part of the state. I think we've learned the lesson that it is useful to invest in the science first. You should keep investing in the science all along, but the science, the basic science of knowing where our springs are, particularly knowing the boundaries of these spring sheds, has been really key in enabling us to implement some of the more far-reaching strategies that are sort of now in play and have happened more recently. The focus on the spring shed was a key concept, an elusive concept. As I said, it was a really empowering concept to people to realize that what they do in their own backyards affects those springs. And it makes people, I think, more champions, more stewards of springs, particularly when you know, you've got a publicly owned situation. Invest in the projects and strategies that have leverage. Again, $2.5 million sounds like a lot, maybe, but it doesn't go a long way when you're starting to implement real on-the-ground projects.
In Texas, as you saw, a lot of the springs are very typical of Texas, and then having to gather out money in Southeast Texas, how would you propose the state is also larger than Florida, that we can group everyone and everyone get excited about this common resource joy to everyone in Texas? Because people physically, you know, in Texas and region, and take money.
Well, it's it's certainly is going to be different. I would doubt that it would be the same in Texas that it evolved in Florida. Nevertheless, we started out with forums like this. Yes, there's a bit more cohesiveness in the places and sort of the culture and the settings of the springs in Florida. But springs is now even a sort of a statewide thing. We've got people in South Florida saying, hey, what about our historic springs down there and in the Keys and places like that? These kinds of forums are very important, sort of, creating that statewide, that broader ethic. But then on the implementation side, I think those concepts like the springs working groups that are tailored to the local regions are important. And maybe there's an answer there somewhere about, how funding could play a role in creating things that are, acting at a local level. Yes, sir, back there.
You mentioned that you have a board of $300 million a year for land conservation, and the people in this room working hard to get relatively modest amounts of money there so we can have functioning state parks from our legislature. How did Florida, a relatively conservative state with Governor Bush, appropriate that much money on a regular basis, and how can we get that here?
Well, again, it's I don't know the answer for Texas specifically. As you just pointed out, there's some commonalities between Texas and Florida, if not just the names of the governors, our past governors. There has long been an environmental ethic in Florida that transcended politics and party affiliation. We've had some of our strongest environmental advocates in the state government have been in Republican administrations. It's a long story. It's a larger version of what I just answered about the springs. It took about 20 years. We're still fighting to keep that program alive, to keep it re-upped. Every time it sunsets, we're in the process now of trying to transition to a $1 billion a year program, believe it or not. And believe it or not, there is not incredible opposition to that, except, you know, where are we going to find the money? But it's a long process of galvanizing people, of pointing out the needs, of pointing out those beautiful places on the landscape and the need for protecting them that's created that ethic in the public that then gets translated to political action. Yes, ma'am.
Frank said that Texas is 75% privately owned. Can you tell us how much Florida is privately owned?
Florida is, I believe, about 65%. We use a kind of a one-third, two-thirds rule. So I think there's about one-third of the state is now, or is approaching. I'm not sure it's actually there yet, but you know, as far as plans for protecting or bringing lands into public ownership, we're looking at about a third of the state. But that includes things like the big, huge water management areas in South Florida that are part of the historic Everglades, the Everglades National Park, a couple of big national forests, and you know, some very large military installations as well. So it's a lower percentage by far than Texas in practice.
And how do you regulate groundwater?
Good question. Florida is a little bit unique. There was a Water Resources Act passed in 1972 that changed the state law. We have neither the prior appropriations kind of a system. Well, that's not groundwater, but we have neither the Western Water Law nor the Eastern Water Law. It's allocation by permit, essentially. And there is a permitting process based on a state groundwater rule that governs the pumping or the withdrawal of groundwater. But it is all permitted by the water management districts. We still have that separation that many states do, including Texas, from between surface water and groundwater in our policies. There's a separate surface water and groundwater rule. The two don't really meet, but I can say that the majority of the folks in the legislature and local politicians and decision makers, actually, even if the law doesn't link it, they are linking it in their minds. There's a clear linkage between groundwater and surface water. Did that answer your question? Okay, I'll take one more. Let's go with the front here. Of that 34,000 acres, now let me just put that in perspective. We've protected about 1 million acres total with that large $300 million a year land acquisition program in 10 years, a little over 10 years. Of that, those 34,000 acres were specifically targeted at springs or spring shed protection. Now, of those, let me think here. I would get long term probably close to 100% of that was state funded. The way the Nature Conservancy gets involved in Florida is that we oftentimes design the projects. We will oftentimes do the real estate work and actually front the money for a time, and then the state buys us out once the timing of their funds are right and can pay back. So even though we hold title to some of those lands that were mentioned there at the moment, over the next 5 years, ultimately the intent is for the state or in some cases some local government entities to buy back those. There's also a partnership in this Florida Forever program between the state government, which puts in the bulk of the money, and some of the counties also have fairly significant land acquisition programs. We think so. They've got a good record so far. That's another role that we and others play, is to make sure that those lands and waters are managed appropriately. But they've got a good record. The state most of these lands tend to go into the state park system, and the Florida State Park Service has as its mission to maintain, I forget the wording exactly, but it's to maintain these lands in the conditions they were prior to European settlement. That's actually in their language, and they've done a very good job.
Would you join me in thanking Mr. Shaw?
Great.
And let's go ahead and take a break. There's still coffee and...